Well, good morning, everybody, and a warm welcome to you all, to those of you that came after I said grace. Today we have Bruce is talking to us. Some of you may have heard just a little glimpse of Bruce's talk at the Anzac service earlier this year, and when I heard that, I thought, oh, I must get Bruce to come and talk to the men and talk in more detail about it, so he agreed to do it. So without any more ado, I'll hand over to Bruce, and if you just come up, Bruce, I'll just pray for you. So, Lord, we just thank you for Bruce and being prepared to talk today to the men. We know that parts of this talk are a bit of a painful experience for Bruce, and so we pray you'll be with him as he's speaking today. And we pray for that what he has to say to us will sort of resonate in our hearts and help us as well in our walk with you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Okay, thank you. I put together a little PowerPoint presentation just to illustrate a couple of things I wanted to talk about, but mainly so that I kept on track and had some structure to this and didn't sound completely stupid. I wanted to talk about four things, I guess, today, and I really wanted to do this relatively briefly because I'm not sure what sort of parts of my story are interesting to people. So I thought if I left lots of time at the end for questioning, you know, we could cover a lot of stuff that way. But I thought I'd talk a bit about my early life and time in the army, what it was like to come home, and I guess a couple of the lessons that I learned as a young person and got reinforced at other times in my life and carried through. For those of you that might be expecting me to talk about a testimony that's all about some Christian conversion, I have to disappoint you because I grew up basically in a church-growing family. My great-great-grandfather was one of the founding pioneers of the Baptist Church in Australia, and according to his records, his diary, they used to baptise people where the Swanston Street Bridge is now, being heckled by everybody else in Melbourne. My grandfather on my mum's side was a Methodist lay preacher, and I grew up as a Methodist. He was also president of the Gideons, so he used to deliver Bibles to every place here and there. And I remember as a kid going off with him to visiting ships and other places like hotels as he delivered Bibles to them. He was quite a feisty old man, I think, because as a very pious Methodist, he resented anything that he considered to be popish. And apparently, when one of the ministers at church, because they in the Methodist church, it was sort of like a circuit, and ministers would preach as often around the circuit as they would in their home church. And whenever a visiting minister came and was more popish than my grandfather liked, he would stand up in the pew and argue theology with him. So I grew up all my life, you know, as a Christian in a church. This is not the church I went to, it's the one that became our church when Methodist and the United Churches all united into the Uniting Church, and this was the church I... But I grew up, I was a Sunday school teacher, and I led the youth group, and in fact the lady who took over my Sunday school class when I went to Vietnam only died the other week, and I still remember her quite fondly. So, you know, we always had this sort of church part of our lives and a faith, and we also always had this sort of, and I think it was been quite a strong support all through my life. I left school. I struggled a bit as a student. I left school barely passing my matric or VCE or year 12 or whatever it might be now, and I was just saying to someone that my early goal was to be a school teacher, and one of the best things that I think ever happened in my life was the education department rejected me, because having done all the things I've now done, I don't think me in the education system would have been suited. So I went to work, and I went to work for a company called Main Nicholas, which was the predecessor of Toll Transport. And the managing director of Main Nicholas was a strong Methodist. He was one of my grandfather's old cronies, as it turned out. And that was quite interesting, being the young office boy, having the support of the managing director. So anyway, but at the age of 20, In those days, at the age of 20, you had to register for national service, and I won the lottery and my number came out. And 6 months later, I found myself in the army, which was something I'd never expected. You know, I was a Boy Scout in my childhood days and liked that. I avoided all the stuff with school cadets with a passion. And here I ended up basically being painted jungle green by the army. So I ended up at Pucca. The army put us through quite a bit of training. I have to say we were pretty well trained. We had 10 weeks of recruit training where they just sort of, yeah, they painted you green, I reckon, is what how I see it. They just socialised you into this military life. And it was really, you know, really quite funny. I remember the day of our march out parade, which is the picture I've got on the left there, and all the parents came up to proudly see their kids. We had a crusty old sergeant, Sergeant Hurd. He was a Korean War veteran. And he had us all lined up on parade, ready to go out and do this march out before our parents were allowed to meet us. And all the mums and dads were lined up in the background. And we had this rather gentle young fellow whose name was Clive, and he was a ladies' hairdresser. And can you imagine, you know, coming from that background to being thrust into the army was quite a change for him. And as Sergeant Hurd approached him, he'd been, you know, getting stuck into people, son, your shoes aren't shiny enough and your boots aren't right and that's a lousy knot in your tie and stand up straight, soldier. And he got to Clive and all of a sudden this voice from the background says, don't you shout at my boy. I still remember that. Anyway, after we marched out, the army had me slated as a pay clerk. And as much as I'm a bit risk averse, I didn't quite want anything that exciting for a couple of years. So I managed through a series of events that are too long to explain, I managed to talk myself into being a driver. So I went off to driver training. And that was fun, playing with the army's trucks and mechanical equipment and learning how to drive and do all the paperwork and all that stuff we had to do. And I got my army records the other month because I just liked to see what was in them. It was sort of quite funny because I actually was the ducks of the class in driver training. I've got a little trophy to commemorate that. And when I look up the army's records, my driving was average. So who understands the army? Anyway, after that, I was posted to a unit at Pucca for a while, and then we had to go off and do our jungle warfare training at Canungra, which was pretty tough because some of that was under live fire and it was very physically demanding, and it was a tough time for 3 weeks at Canungra. But that really equipped us. I actually think for me, the training was probably harder than the war. So after I'd been in the army I had to do 2 years as a national serviceman. We didn't like ever being called conscripts, and we regarded ourselves as national servicemen or nashos, as we called. So there were two levels of people in the army. There were two types of people, I should say, rather than levels. There were the regular soldiers and there were the nashos. And after all that training, you couldn't tell the difference between us, except there was always this banter between the regs and the nashos, and that just went on a bit. But after about 10 months, I guess, I'd been in the army, I ended up going to Vietnam. I perhaps could have got out of it, but I decided that I was just going to take whatever came and accept it and do whatever I could and do it the best way I could. That was just what you did, along with all the other thousands of guys. So I got posted to this unit, 85 Transport Platoon, which still exists. It still operates now out of Amberley. And at our reunions, which we have every couple of years, we still have the current commanding officer and the troop sergeant come and talk to us, because the mistake we make is we think it's still like it used to be, and that's 50 years ago, so it's nothing like that at all. But our unit was based at Nui Dat. We had probably three bases in Vietnam, if you discount Saigon, which was just the administrative base. We had an Air Force base at Phan Rang, where they flew Canberras and based some of their transport aircraft. We had a logistics base at Bung Tao down on the coast where all the supplies and stores came in because there was a port there. And we had our fighting base or task force base up at Nui Dat, which was about 27 kilometres to the north, right in the centre of the Phuc Thuy province that we had responsibility for. And being a driver was actually pretty good because we got out, and so I think I saw more of that province than most other people did because we were always out working, doing things. So to give you a very quick overview, the sort of things we did, we had three sections in our unit. Now here's the value of having my PowerPoint because I would have missed this. This is basically a couple of quick photos of the conditions there. The tent was my home for 12 months with three other, shared work with three other fellows, two of whom I still keep in touch with. And the mess where we ate, the mess probably fed 80 men. And I had a couple of weeks at Vung Tau, but I think the food at Nui Dat was always much better. So that stood out. But we had three units. One was task force maintenance. We were like the local sort of council, if you like, that supplied and supported the task force. So about a third of our time we would have spent taking ammunition down to the helipad for dispatch out to the fire support bases, delivering water, collecting garbage, delivering rations, doing the ice run. That was always pretty good because what you could do, and the Americans had a big ice works down at Vung Tau. We used to take two tippers down every day and bring back big blocks of ice. You know, they were probably half a metre square and 2 metres long. And even though a bit melted on the way, they were to support all the messes and cool down the drinks and stuff. But what you could do if you're on the ice run is if you could manage to sneak a slouch hat out of the Q store, you could actually swap that for almost anything with the Americans. And one guy managed to swap it for a Jeep one day. But the standard thing was to try and get... We were rationed to 2 cans of beer a man per day, so there wasn't a lot of alcohol around. And I might explain a little bit why that was later on. And if you could manage to get a six-pack of Australian beer, you could actually trade that down at the ice works for an extra half block of ice. And for that extra half block of ice, you could break it up into quarters and you can trade it for another six-pack of beer at each of the messes you delivered it to. And that was a really good trade. And that worked really well until one of our guys rolled his truck over one day completely drunk at 10 o'clock in the morning. But part of our work was just supporting the task force, just delivering stuff around the base. The base held 5,000 men, had a perimeter of 13 kilometres. It was very, very widespread so that if we ever got rocketed or mortared, you know, there wasn't a concentration of things that were going to get hit. I spent about half of my time in Vietnam driving tippers. And we did two or three things with these. One was we built a lot of roads, and it was sort of almost in a way really positive to be working with the engineers, doing some work that was constructive rather than destructive. So we built a lot of the roads around Vietnam, and whenever the Viet Cong blew up a road or a bridge, like in the right-hand photo, we would take rock out and we would repair it and fill it in. So a lot of construction work and a lot of repair work took place with tippers. And in a way, tippers were good to drive because you weren't carrying troops and they didn't argue with you. Or the rock didn't argue with you. And I spent half of my time driving cargo trucks. And these were trucks that were the standard sort of army design. They could be converted to carrying troops. You could put you could use them as a tray truck, or you could put sides on them and use them as a, you know, conventional truck. So in the left photograph here, we're taking stores out to a fire support base. Whenever the infantry operated well outside our base, they would always operate under cover of artillery. So the artillery would set up a fire support base at some remote location, a battery of 3 guns with some protection. And it was our job to go out, if we couldn't get helicopters, to go out and resupply them with ammunition, food and stuff. And on the right-hand side, we were out refueling an armoured operation that was well outside our area of operation. So a whole range of activities that were all transport-related. So we drove around and got to see a whole range of stuff that was really interesting. We didn't get much opportunity to mix with the local population, because we were sort of kept securely within the wire of our perimeter wire of our base. Although we did befriend lots of little kids, and we're very grateful. We were doing a job with our tippers one day, carrying rock out to a village that was clearly a Viet Cong village, because you'd go through that village one day and find that there was no one but women and children in the village. And the next day you'd go through and find that there was full of young men, and they were all the local Viet Cong having coffee and on leave for the day. And we used to pick up the little kids and take them for a ride and give them rations from our lunchbox and stuff. One day we picked up a couple of little kids and started to drive into the village, and they sort of said, no, 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 stop. And we'd found that the Viet Cong had mined the road that night. So if it hadn't been for those kids, we might not have been around in such a healthy condition. So that was nice. So that was my time. It was really just a time of work. We had half a day off a week on Sundays. I didn't drink a lot in those days, so I got to drive the beach trip quite a lot. We used to take a truck of diggers down to the beach at Vung Tau for a bit of R&R each Sunday, and I was quite regularly rostered onto that truck as the driver. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, just to skip through a couple of main topics and then have some time for questions. I want to talk about the protest movement, because that was a real issue for us. The Vietnam War was very, very contentious, you know, as you'll remember. It happened during the 1970s, which in any event was a period of really radical social change. You know, it was the same time that the movie or the stage show Hair came out, and you had the first nudity on stage. It was the time of the dawning of feminism. It was the dawning of, you know, the drug age with LSD and dope being around. I actually just come back from California, and it's surprising how many hippies there still are all along the beaches in California. They've just all got grey hair and look wrinkled. But the original protests for Vietnam probably were the ones that would have always protested, and that's the mums who started out the Save Our Sons movement. But by the time I got back from Vietnam, the protest movement had become hijacked by everyone. It had become hijacked by the communists who were out there protesting about the imperialist invasion of Vietnam. It got hijacked by the feminists who were protesting about the male-oriented problems of war. And that even continued well after that. And, you know, on the Anzac Day march, we had a group of women who'd set up a table and a protest station on the Anzac Day route about protesting about the rape of women in war, which was completely irrelevant to us, but it was their thing. The unions protested. The waterside workers refused to load our supply ship, the Japaret, and the Navy took it over. The posties decided not to deliver our mail. So almost every letter, you know, was sent home with a little acronym on the back, and if you sent it to your girlfriend, it had swalk on it, sealed with a loving kiss. If it was sent to your parents, you had PAP, punch a postie. You know, while it was their right to protest, the problem was it affected us who had, you know, no say in it. We weren't old enough to vote at that stage, yet here we were fighting a war. It divided families. You know, my brother was strongly in the moratorium movement, marching up Collins Street to Parliament House, or Bourke Street to Parliament House, while I'm in a war zone. So it was really, really difficult. And that became very difficult, you know, when we all got home, because as troops, and it's exactly the same in America, I was talking to a Vietnam veteran in America the other week, and we were exchanging experiences, and he was saying that he actually had a bumper sticker on his car, and it said something like, never again will they protest about the people who were protecting their freedom. And that was the sort of way, rightly or wrongly, I think we felt about it. I'll tell you a story that sometimes I find hard to tell, because I get quite emotional telling this story, because it meant a lot to me. But, you know, I didn't say anything about being in Vietnam for a long time after I got home, because you never knew how people were going to react. I had a mate in Warrnambool who had a teacher that he adored, And she was a very significant part of his life. And when he got home, first thing he did was to go back and visit her and say hello, and I'm safe, and here I am back again, thinking that she'd be impressed or value that or whatever. And she spat in his face and called him a baby killer. And so we never really knew what type of reaction we'd get. So we just went to ground. And I didn't talk about being in Vietnam for about 17 years. And the best thing that ever happened was in 1987, the veterans organised a welcome home march, and it followed the one in Sydney. And I thought, I'm not going to go to that. And Jill, my wife, said, yes, you are. You'd better go. So she talked me into going. So I thought, well, I'll go if I can find someone to go with. And I had a mate in the army whose name was Max Dong. And he had a Chinese ancestry from somewhere in the background. And I thought, well, I'm sure I can look him up, because I knew he lived in a suburb in Sydney, and I can find him. So I rang him up and said, hey, Max, I'll go if you go. He said, all right, we'll go together. So anyway, I booked a weekend package to Sydney with Australian Airlines, and part of that was a stay at the Intercontinental Hotel, because it was not far from Circular Quay where I was going to meet up with Max. When I got to the airport, instead of going and collecting my bag off the baggage belt, this is 17 years after I got home, I went up to the Qantas Club, or what was then the Australian Airlines lounge, because I knew there was a phone there. It was well before we had mobile phones. And I thought, I'll ring Max and reassure myself that he's still going to be there. So I was chatting to him on the phone for a few minutes, and we organised a meeting time. And the woman behind me turned around and she said, are you a Vietnam veteran? I said, yes. She said, well, welcome home. That was the start of this whole magical weekend. You know, I met up with Max. We went up to the domain where we were meeting. And lo and behold, there were the other 60 guys from my unit. I hadn't seen any of them, you know, for 17 years. We'd been in touch with them. So we marched through the streets of Sydney, got to dinner that night, and Max says, I know a great Asian restaurant. He said, up near Central Station, called the Malaysian. He said, why don't we go there for dinner? So off we went and walked in the door, and there were the other 60 guys. And then we're walking back to the Circular Quay for him to go home and see his mum, or back home to stay with his mum. And he said, you know, there was, because he wasn't in my unit. This is a bloke I met in driver training. And he'd actually been assigned to the hospital as a driver. And he said, there was one bloke I really would have loved to have caught up with. He was an electrician at the hospital. He said, one bloke, if ever I could meet up with, I'd like to meet up with him. So I thought, well, why don't we go into this bar here and have a drink just on the way back? And sure enough, there was this same fellow. So this whole weekend was just cathartic. It was just a wonderful time of, you know, everything becoming all right. You know, it just opened it all up, and it made it positive. So I have to say, I'm really now a very proud Vietnam veteran. That sort of continued on to the opening of the Vietnam Memorial in Sydney, in Canberra, I'm sorry, which is now in that avenue that leads up to the War Memorial. So I now wear my medals with a bit of pride. I'm very happy to declare something that for a long time I wasn't really all that comfortable doing. So what were the things I learned? When I got out of the army and got back into civilian life, I went back to work. I was grateful for three or four things, I think. One was that everybody at the church I was going to had kept in touch with me, or through, you know, the network had known what we were doing. So I had this whole church to come back to. And that made it a lot easier for me than a lot of other veterans. Had a very supportive family. And I had a very supportive boss. My boss back at work was an old British soldier who'd been captive in Singapore. And so he had a lot of empathy for me, and that really helped a lot as well. I went on later on and did a degree part-time in psychology, and I got registered as an industrial and vocational psychologist, and then went off and worked for a few companies and ran my own little consulting company for 29 years and retired just 3 years ago. But the things I learned, I reckon, if I go right back to that time in the army, were these. Firstly, I think, you know, we really need to give our support to people who are in tough environments. The guys in Vietnam that had the hardest time were the ones that didn't have any family support, whose girlfriend had left, and they were on their own. And I think we need to remember, or at least I do, that when people are having a tough time, the support of others is really important. And it's for that reason I've had a couple of my friends end up in jail for various offences. And I've really made the point that I should put my own needs and values aside and go and visit them and support them, because they needed that. Otherwise, they'd be on their own too. So I think remembering people in tough times is really important. Secondly, I think we need to take responsibility for our own success or failure. I have this impression that we've been through a generation of what I call they people, you know, people who haven't accepted much responsibility for themselves and think that they should do something else about it. You know, they should look after me. They should give me a bigger pension. They should fund this. They should fund that, rather than getting on with it and doing it yourself, because if you don't do that, nothing else really happens. And I look at Vietnam veterans and I understand what's happening, but I think if I look at Vietnam veterans, there's a continuum, I think, of three different sorts. On one end, like me, I think there's guys who had an experience and put that down as part of their life and get on with life and are fairly well adjusted and okay. The other end, I think there are guys that are completely screwed up by their experience, and they've got a right to be, because they had some terrible times, they did some tough things, and life wasn't really easy for them. You know, I had a mate who died just a few weeks ago that I went through recruit training with, and he got posted to the infantry, and he has been in and out of the psych ward of the Repat hospital, you know, for years and years and years. And he's riddled with guilt. And his guilt was that out on patrol one day, his mate at the time, because you had to have a mate, that was part of, you know, having someone to support you, his mate got almost cut in half by machine gun fire. And here's Johnny saying, why wasn't it me? Why couldn't I have done more? He said, all I could do was watch him die. He's on that end up here who I think are quite entitled to have post-traumatic stress. And then there's a bunch of guys in the middle who I'm not ever sure about, because they didn't do anything harder or tough or more demanding than I did, yet they appear to have a whole lot of psychological and long-term problems too. And I think for them, you've got to give them the benefit of the doubt and put them on, you know, that side of the fence. But one of the things that I get disappointed about, I think, with Vietnam veterans is that we have the highest incidence of TPIs, you know, totally and permanently incapacitated, out of any war. And I think a lot of guys have just played the game and they use their TPI income as the superannuation fund they would never have had. It's sort of hard to, I guess it comes to another point I'm making, and that is that you've got to understand people. I think we've got to take responsibility for doing things ourselves. And I think the encouragement I'd like to give to my granddaughters is you can do anything you want. You can be anything you like, but you've just got to go and do it and not expect it to be given to you. And the third thing, I guess, is that we'll probably have far better relationships with others. I think about my relationship with God in this way. We'll have far better relationships with others if we try to understand them and where they're coming from, rather than imposing ourselves onto them. Because people do things for their reasons, not for ours. And if I can understand their reasons for behaving in a certain way, I can probably work out how best to relate to them, rather than just trying to say, well, here's where I'm coming from, and like it or lump it, I'm just going to give it to you. And I learnt that a lot with my three tent mates, who came from very, very different backgrounds. And I was probably the most naive of all of them. Once I started to get into their heads and see where they were coming from, I think we had much better relationships. So that's my story in a very brief nutshell. I wanted to leave a lot of time for questions, so I'm really happy for people to ask, you know, anything or whatever they like. because, as I said, it seems to be much more helpful if I talk about the things that are interesting to you rather than just to me.
Bruce, we've seen documentaries recently of those soldiers in Vietnam having gone back to Vietnam to reconcile mm-hmm. with the people and seeing what the situation is now. Is that something you have done or are considering doing?
I've been back to Vietnam 3 times. I don't have any ghosts to bury. I'm just interested to see how the country's developing, because I thought it was a beautiful place. And I like the people's sense of... I'm not sure what the word is. I like the sense of how they want to get on, you know, and how they want to improve. And I'm just interested to see how it's developing and is developing. I think last time I was there, it's clearly probably going to be the next Thailand of Asia. Two reasons. One is because in Vietnam they call it the American War, so the Americans tend to cop any of the flak. And the other reason is that the average age of Vietnam is very young. I think it's only 37 or something. So there's not many people that remember the war, and most of the people I speak to are more curious than they are antagonistic.
Bruce, last time I talked to you about this, first of all, sorry, thank you. Thank you for what you're sharing. The last time I talked to you about this, you also mentioned about the work the Australian Army did in terms of infrastructure and helping the Vietnamese community. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because that was really something quite a revelation for me.
Yeah. I think one of the very big differences between us and the Americans in Vietnam during the war was that we did a lot more community support work. We actually had a civil affairs unit that was dedicated to helping local people. They put up windmills in villages, we built roads, worked on civil aid projects. And that happened right during the war because we recognised that in a guerrilla-type war, you're not going to win purely militarily. You have to capture the hearts and minds of people, and we aimed to do that, although that was pretty hard in that environment. After the war, I think the Australian government was the first foreign government to recognise the Vietnam, and there's been an enormous amount of welfare put into Vietnam in places like bridges over the Mekong, and community facilities, as well as some of the diggers taking responsibility for going back and building schools and kindergartens. So we've done quite a bit, you know, on a per capita basis, I think, to contribute.
Bruce, thank you again. I'm interested, the Australian government didn't really handle the return, as you've said, the return episodes. Has it learned anything since then with Afghanistan, Iraq and so on? Have you talked to any of the men or women who have come back from more recent wars? Do you feel as though they're being welcomed? Or is the situation very much the same for the returnees, or has it improved?
I'm probably not a good person to ask, but my sense is that it's improved dramatically. Couple of reasons. One is that I know that I think in the church service on Anzac Day, I contrasted my experience with my dad. You know, my grandfather in World War One, he took 6 months to get home after his time of war. So he had a lot of period to adjust. My dad had 6 or 8 weeks. I was a machine gunner on a gun jeep escorting convoys one day and home with mum the next, literally. And I think now there's a compulsory period in the military of, not long, but I think it's a week or so's debriefing, where when anyone comes home from an active area, they have to go and spend a week debriefing. And part of that, I think, is to ascertain whether there's any issues that they need support with. Part of it's also an intelligence gathering and a learning process for the military. But it's still a bit tough to do. I met the head of the army a little while ago at one of our reunions, and he was telling me that he would like to find ways of supporting people in that time was coming back from Iraq. And he was saying that the problem, though, is that it's the toughest time, because as soon as you get back home, all the guys want to do is go out surfing and go out meeting their mates. they're not interested in sitting down with a psychologist and talking about their experience. They want to get out of there. And he said that while they're trying to find a way of doing it, it's the toughest time to capture people because they're just less open to being helped. But it just comes out later. But I've got a sense that the community now has quite different values, and the government does, and the military as an organisation does as well. But I'm not really the best person to ask.
Bruce, if I can ask you a question. You said you've got a supportive family, but you also said you had your brother was protesting, was it? And then I just was interested in how that relationship has gone on over the time. And then also the church, you said the church had been supportive. And did you find that they weren't part of this anti-war movement, or that the church really fully understood what was happening?
I don't remember anyone at the church I was at being in an anti-war movement. My brother and I have completely different views on almost everything, you know, whether it's politics or religion or everything. I don't know how it happened in the same family, but I guess as we've got older and more mature, we just tolerate each other now more than we used to. Yeah.
This is probably a very big question, but it seems that Australia fight wars that have no value to Australia and not necessarily have any moral rationality, you know, weapons of mass destruction that never existed. So I think, you know, our politicians need to be more open with us, but the people are much more vocal in their resistance. I don't know if there's any hope that our politicians will take better decisions in the future, but, you know, it's just a big question.
Yeah, it is a big question. I don't know the answer. In fact, you know, I'm not really quite sure why I was in Vietnam. At the time, I guess the government had, from their perspective, quite a legitimate concern about communism, you know, because it was in the middle of the Cold War. China was increasing its... This is my history from what I've read. China was increasing its significance in the world, and they were concerned about the domino theory, that if Vietnam fell, then Thailand would fall and then Indonesia would fall and we'd have communists on our doorstep. But I think that was, looking back on it, quite irrelevant, because communism was only really relevant in countries where it was better than the current alternative, and that would have never have been the case here. Another sort of theory, I guess, or hypothesis is that by being involved in Vietnam, we got a big reduction on American military equipment, so maybe I was a discount on the F-111s. but I actually don't know why we were there either. I ponder on that, and you know, some people will say we slowed down communism by 10 years, and other people will say there was no real reason for being there at all. But the only thing I can conclude, listening to a number of historians, is that at the day, the government was genuinely concerned about the spread of communism. Yeah, look, I'm not a political historian, so I'm not really sure. I don't know, but maybe.
Bruce, thank you very much. It was a time that many of us lived through, and you've given me a new perspective on it. One thing I'd like to ask is that in many young men's lives, this is probably the most significant thing that ever happened to them. They went from mundane lives and came back to mundane lives. And so their friendship, their bonding, their comrades, is that part of the thing that makes a lot of guys never able to move on, because the best thing that ever happened to them in a perverse sort of a way?
I'm not sure it's the best thing that ever happened to them. It's probably the most significant thing that ever happened to them. And I've got people I meet at our unit reunions, which we hold every couple of years, who, because it's the most significant thing that's ever happened to them, make Vietnam their whole life. Where others have moved, like me, have moved on from that, seen other parts of the world and done other things, and I'm very happy now to say it's part of my life, but not all of it. But I think that's right. And it is for some people. It certainly was, you know, for soldiers in the First World War, because if you were a storekeeper in Elsternwick and you volunteered for the Western Front, that was a lot different from spending your life in the four walls of your drapery shop, wasn't it? And for some Vietnam veterans, that would be similar too. I also think that for some people, especially the more reclusive ones, that they find it difficult to talk about because their perception is that no one else would understand. You know, I know my grandfather hardly ever talked about World War I, according to my aunt and parents. And that was because he perceived that what was the point of talking to someone who'd never experienced it and wouldn't understand it? And I can really empathise with that. So there's some of that as well, I think, if that answers your question.
Bruce, thanks very much indeed. If I could just make a couple of comments. One, just in relation to that last point about people's experience and what they brought back. At the time of the Vietnam War, I was in the personnel area of the Commonwealth Bank, and it was my job to keep track of all of the Nashos, so yep. to speak, and to make sure they got paid and so on. When they came back, inevitably, many of them said this was the best thing that happened to them personally in terms of giving them some structure and direction in life. They learnt a lot out of that. Secondly, I've just been reading recently the book awarded the Christian Book of the Year Award in 2015 called Captains of the Soul, which charts the history of chaplains in the war from the going back prior to the First World War, but right up until now. Would you care to comment on what you saw or perceived of the role of chaplains in your time in the Army?
Yeah, the chaplain I remember most was Howard Dillon, who was the Anglican chaplain. Some of you might not remember him from being around. I think he became, didn't he lead St. James, Mission of St. James and St. John at one stage? Yeah, well, he was a great guy. And important for two reasons. One was because of the spiritual support that chaplains gave. But the other part that we overlook, I reckon, or I never understood was important, was, if you like, the moral guidance that chaplains gave. Because if you take a cross-section of society, not everybody had the same view of morality. And I look at, I think sometimes now I look at some of these fellows when we go to an Anzac Day service and there's a hymn and a prayer. That was probably their annual dose of religion. So I think chaplains were really very important in those times. I think it's part of my first point up here that we need to give people support in tough times. You actually might even know a couple of the blokes I served with if you were looking after Nashos in those days, because I've got a couple of mates who are in the Commonwealth Bank. I was going to say that I don't know, though, that I think for me, my time in national service was actually a very developmental time. I wouldn't be the same person now that I would have been without that. You know, I grew up in a very naive, sort of protected environment, and my time in national service gave me much more worldly experience. It exposed me to a whole range of different people. It increased my personal confidence. I just matured a lot. You know, I was engaged at the time I went to Vietnam, and I got home and found that my girlfriend at the time, or fiance, she'd sort of dematured 5 years by comparison. You know, I just matured a lot. So for me it was good, but it's not good for everyone. I have a mate, you might know the name Beraldo Coffey. I've seen that around the community. Well, Paul Beraldo and I are old mates now because we met each other in recruit training. He grew up in a tough family, tough Italian migrant family in Preston. He's now a very, very different person. But he'd tell you he probably would be in jail without national service. Yet my mate Max, I was telling you about it from the reunion, he was a really soft, gentle soul, and they gave him the worst possible job ever. He was taking bodies from the hospital to the airstrip to be flown home. And he couldn't handle that. He went really, not crazy, but he that really affected him. So I think you've got to look at that. People say, yeah, we should all bring back national service. It's good for people. But I don't think it is. Not for everyone. For some people it is, but not for everyone.
A couple of opinions, or some of us have got opinions about whether it's worthwhile participating in a conflict or not. And I think both sides have got valid arguments. But it's far enough ago now that there have been some brilliant historical books written about it. And one that's well worth reading is Vietnam by Paul Hamm.
Oh, yes, yes. Yep.
And I think one of our problems in this country is that we put aside, we I do it too, so it's not, I'm not having a shot at anybody, but we do it, we take a position and we don't actually find out the information about what was there at the time because we weren't there.
Well, that's right. One of the things I think that the protesters and the moratorium movement overlook is the amount of sadistic terrorism that the local population were exposed to by the Viet Cong. You know, and Paul Hamm writes about that. He writes about how in some of the villages that we worked in day by day, the village chief was murdered because he was anti-communist. Or they disemboweled pregnant women to make a point. Or they murdered children to show their parents that they ought to change their political attitude. And that stuff doesn't come out. You know, there's a lot of stuff from the moratorium movement about how terrible we were and the war crimes we committed. But I'm not to say that we were totally blameless. But the other side gets overlooked. You're right. Well, yeah, just while we're getting to that, we transported a group of Cambodian refugees because the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia and the war was happening in Cambodia at the same time. We took a convoy of about 20 trucks full of Cambodian refugees from Vung Tau one day up to a resettlement village. And there were men and women and children all carrying their, you know, everything from chickens to pigs to cooking pots. Loaded them on the back of trucks and took them up to this village. And that night, the Viet Cong came and murdered their headman because they wanted to show them that who was really in control. So it wasn't one-sided at all.
Bruce, thank you for introducing us to a different facet of the glass half-full theory. I guess many of us didn't have much of an idea of the power of half an ice block. And how far half an ice block would be half an ice block and what you could buy with it, let alone the currency of the slouch hat. Thanks for that. But I'm wondering whether some of your experience as a national serviceman was one of the drivers or had an influence on your choice of career afterwards.
Well, that's a good question. And the answer probably is I don't really know myself. I was never very scientific at school. I wasn't strong in the sciences. And I had a bit of a yen towards working with people, which is why I wanted to be a teacher. I thought I wanted to be a teacher. And I ended up in the personnel department of Main Nicholas, so I had a bit of a shared background with Doug. I don't know whether it affected me at all or I just decided I'd go back for stability to do the same thing. I went back and continued on the same sort of work, but I probably don't think it did, is the real answer.
Okay, guys, I think if that's... we're getting close to finishing, and I just want to thank Bruce for being so open and honest about what it was like for you. And I realise it was very painful, so thank you. Yeah, some parts of it. So let's give... Bruce and Hannah.